Good morning.
Gotcha.
My name is Vlad Spino. I'm the president of the Molow Foundation. We have a nice and important event, Federalism and Separatism, the case of Moldova. We have the audience here, the Open Society Foundations, that kindly agreed to host us. And we also have a large audience online. The event is live streaming and can be viewed on Ustream, Moldova.org, Moldova Foundation websites. For me personally and for the Moldova Foundation, this is a very significant event because 10 years ago, as a fresh graduate from Harvard, I came to Washington with a concrete idea to set up a foundation that will focus on Moldova. It was an impossible task back then because Moldova was little known in Washington, in the United States in general, probably except the desk officer at the State Department and several other people knew about Moldova as professionals. So I made rounds here in Washington to different organizations, and one organization that liked my idea was the Open Society Institute, was called back then. And Jonas Roulette, who is today and helped to organize this event, said, we will support you. And since then, the Open Society is funding the Moldova Foundations to enable us to organize events like we have today. So thank you, Jonas. Thank you, Adna Karamehik from the Open Society, who also was with us for this long period of time, 10 years. Also, it was very hard and difficult. We had money, promised money, but we didn't have network, so we didn't have diaspora that will support us, like in other cases, Lithuanians, Ukrainians, and so forth. So we decided to set up a Friends of Moldova group. We were able to get together former U.S. ambassadors to Moldova, one of the, actually the first ambassador to Moldova, Mary Pendleton, John Todd Stewart, Pamela Smith, who is with us today, many representatives of the think tanks and organizations that have programs in Moldova joining the group. And for 10 years, we debated, brainstormed issues related to Moldova. We focused for 10 years, the Moldova Foundations focused on two mainly important issues. One is democratization, the support to the civil society in Moldova, and the second is the conflict in the Transnistria region of Moldova. And today we'll have the chance to discuss. The second significance for me of this event is that the first event in 2004 we had public was a response to the federalization of Moldova proposed by Russia through Kozak Memorandum that you will hear today. I went to Chisinau, to Moldova, and along with Wazun Antoi, who is here today, and Ambassador Igor Munteanu, who was the Viitoro Foundation back then, decided to create a strategy that will change totally the approach towards the Transnistrian conflict. Instead of proposing a status to a portion of the country, to a country that is partially occupied by Russia, we decided to change totally the approach. We need to create an environment where the conflict could be solved by removing the obstacles, Russian troops, the criminalization elements, or criminal elements that were in Transnistria and in Chisinau that benefited from this conflict, and after that, to work with the civil society and strengthen it, both on the left and on the right side of the Dniester River. Another element, and I'm sure that we'll have a nice discussion because we put together one of the best people in Washington and in Europe that focused on the Transnistrian conflict. One element that I would like to propose to discuss for the panel and for you, for the audience, is about not only federalization. Federalization is a kind of one set of ideas and issues, but let not forget that this portion of land is part of a larger portion of land that was grabbed from Romania in 1940 by the Soviet Union, occupied by force. And to force a federalization of this portion of land, I think, needs to have legal ground, moral ground, and ethical ground. So this is just to give you some idea about what I'm thinking back then in 2004 when we proposed the 3D strategy, why federalization is not good. And this is why I was not a moderator and we picked up a very good moderator because I am biased in this regard. I will ask Jonas Roulette to say a few words about the current political situation that actually influenced very much the settlement of the Transnistrian conflict and we'll go forward. Thank you very much, and we'll talk at the Q&A.
Thanks, Vlad. Just a quick word of thanks to Vlad and the Moldova Foundation, not just for setting up this event, but for 10 years of very fruitful collaboration. It's a really wonderful example of civil society when one person obsessed with an issue or an idea mobilizes a community around those issues. I'm going to just very, very briefly set the table. The panel will serve the full meal. Most of you know that the big change in Moldova, occurred in 2009 when social unrest forced a second election within a three-month period and resulted in a new government, widely considered reformist. At that time, Moldova made a more pronounced turn toward Europe and a market economy. In fact, the government was composed of four parties in a coalition collectively called the Alliance for European Integration, so no mistaking their intentions. They were uneasy partners from the start. The parties coalesced around individual leaders who shared a broad program and similar ambitions, including the ambition to lead. But they were based in somewhat different segments of society. And so the story of the last 4 years has really been about two conflicting dynamics. On the one hand, you have Moldova yearning for Europe and the EU returning the embrace, which has been a great stimulus to reform. And on the other, you've had rivalries among coalition partners, which has been a great obstacle to reform. Although the coalition survived repeated failures to elect a new president and a subsequent parliamentary election, the scale of tensions were revealed in March of this year when the government fell, only weeks short of signing association and free trade agreements with the EU. The former coalition parties essentially declared war on each other. I think it's not an overstatement. And this led to a lot of maneuvering that did great harm to the country's democratic project. Laws were passed overnight, changing the electoral system and according parliament the power to sack judges on the constitutional court. And this sort of undemocratic behavior was really a great shock to the EU and to others like OSF, who had invested in the reform project in the belief that this was a kind of historical inflection point for Moldova. Strong messages from the international community about the impropriety of the legislative changes and the need to stabilize things in Chisinau helped pull things back from the brink, as did a tacit armistice among the contending parties. As of last week, there's a new government in place headed by Yuri Lianca, who's formerly the foreign minister and is a member of the Liberal Democrats. Many observers are predicting a difficult term for this government, but there is the opportunity to set the country back on the course of democratic reform and enhance European perspective. There's a great deal more to be said about presidential politics, the judiciary, Transnistria, corruption, the country's lovely wine, and even lovelier people, but I'm out of time, so I'm going to pass it over to Chris. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonas. Morning, I'm Chris Borgen. I'm a professor of law at St. John's University School of Law in New York. And I've been asked to essentially play three roles this morning. The first thing that I'm going to do is for a few minutes talk about the topic in general, this topic of federalism and power sharing. The next thing that I will do is I'll introduce the panelists that we have with us this morning for our discussion. And then finally, just say a few words about the format of the discussion and play a role in moderating it. So without any further ado, a few words about federalism and power sharing. Let me explain. First of all, I want to thank Vlad Spanu and everybody at the Moldova Foundation, Jonas Rolette and Adna Karamehek, and everybody at OSI for putting together this panel, because this is a very interesting and very important topic, and it's particularly one that I think causes a lot of confusion. So I think it's especially good one to have to put together a panel with a series of views. I first sort of started hearing about questions of federalism and Moldova as when I was part of a group from the New York City Bar that was asked to do a legal assessment of issues in the conflict over Transnistria. Here's a picture of us with Igor Smirnov standing in the middle. And there's one Mark Meyer here was the head of the delegation. And one person in particular I'm going to talk about is this person right here. His name is Barrington Parker. He's a senior judge in the U.S. He's a federal judge in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And the reason he comes into this story a little bit is because we were having discussions with various members of the Transnistrian leadership. And at one point, they said, look, all that we want is federalism, like what you have in the United States. That's all that we're asking for. So Judge Parker, who is one of the top constitutional lawyers in the U.S., said, oh, really? That's great. And he gave a sort of, he said, so this is what you want. And he gave about a 7 or 8 minute introduction to the idea of American federalism. Now, this is coming from really one of the top judges in the U.S., so this is the type of thing that any law student or lawyer would love to hear. And he sort of very nicely laid out the ways that power is shared in the U.S. in a U.S. federal structure. And he said, So basically, that's what you're asking for? And they all looked horrified and said, no, we don't want that. And then when he said, well, what is it that you want? And then when they described it, our response was, well, that's asking for statehood. That's a separate state. That's a little bit different than when we talk about federalism. So the point that I want to start, and really the sort of the motif in my opening talk, is that a lot of times debates about federalism are really misunderstandings about vocabulary. We use the same word, but we're meaning different things. So what I wanted to do, what I wanted to set out for just a couple of minutes before we begin our whole discussion is one way we can think about the vocabulary. It's not the only way. I just wanted to sort of maybe set out a few different ideas and focus maybe less on the specific title or the specific words and focus more on the underlying sort of political power structures that we're talking about. So there are a few different ways that you can share power within a state. One is what we would generally call territorial power sharing. Now this is, I'll talk more about this in a moment, but this is where you have different territorial areas. Let's call them, for example, New York, New Jersey, and California, and they have a certain amount of power. And there might also be power that's given to the overall government, the federal government that oversees all of the territory. There's also something that's called community-based power sharing, sometimes called consociational power sharing. That's based not on chunks of territory, but on membership in particular groups. Sometimes this could be viewed as ethnic groups or national groups or so on. And that there would be perhaps some different rules or different rights, political rights, that different groups have within a single state. And as in most things in life, many times what you find is neither purely one nor the other, but some type of mix in many types of constitutions, which includes some type of territorial power sharing and some type of consociationalism. So to say just a few words about this, for one thing is that I want to note that this is something that many political scientists have been writing about for many years, at least the last 40 years, in terms of thinking about the relationship of power sharing to conflict reduction. And these are just a few of these people, including Aaron Lippert, Hurst Hannum from Fletcher, Mark Weller at Cambridge, who's written extensively on this, Stefan Wolf, who is also focused in particular on issues in Moldova and Transnistria, and Brendan O'Leary from the University of Pennsylvania. I just want to mention them because what I'm putting up here isn't things that I've just certainly come up with. This is more like reviewing a very rich literature that exists in these areas. So to dig in just a little bit into some of these ideas, there's confederalism, which is one type of territorial power sharing. So I mentioned territorial power sharing as overall, but within that, there are a few different types. So you can have confederalism, which is when you have two or more sovereigns or nearly sovereign entities that are in a very loose affiliation. Here, the most of the power is within each of the confederation members, and there's only a very light agreement or sort of a very light tie between the two. It's difficult to pick a sort of a clear example of a confederation. Some people might say that Serbia-Montenegro, when it was still together, could have been viewed as a confederation. There's also federalism. Now, this is a division of power between territorial units, and there's a shared rule between the subnational units and the federal or national government, like what we have in the United States or what there is in Mexico, for example. One thing that I just want to note here is that there's also the idea of asymmetrical federalism, which sometimes isn't focused on. And that is that of the various subnational units, they don't necessarily all have to have the same rights. Now, this is different than how we've organized things here in the United States, where each of the 50 states essentially have the same sets of rights. But you can also think of the District of Columbia, which doesn't. So that would be an example of, in one particular case, an issue of asymmetrical federalism. So as I mentioned here, you could look at the U.S. and you could look at Mexico. For an international example of asymmetrical federalism, various writers have looked at Bosnia-Herzegovina, where the different subnational units actually have different sets of political rights. And there's also autonomy. Now, autonomy we can think of as being a separate unit within a state, and that separate unit has a high degree of self-government. One sort of tagline that you could think about in comparing autonomy to the other examples of territorial power sharing is that it's an issue of devolution rather than decentralization. If in the US you have a decentralization of power amongst 50 states, autonomy is where you have a particular area within a state in which large amounts of power is given to that area for its own rule, and so it's a devolution of power to that specific area. And an example that people use is sometimes they talk about Moldova, specifically Gagauzia. And you can also think perhaps of autonomy within the Russian Federation, of some of the autonomous regions. There's no one way to define autonomy or to make something autonomous. I'm talking here about sort of very broad categories. So this is now just sort of is just what I had on the previous few slides. So that's just within just territorial power sharing, three different ways that you can think about it. So this is to point out federalism doesn't have to be reduced to a yes or no question, yes federalism or no to federalism. Territorial power sharing itself is a whole spectrum of options. And you can mix and match. And maybe a way to think about it is not just as a spectrum, but it's more like a palette in which you have lots of different paints, and you can paint a picture taking from different parts of the palette depending on how you want to organize a state. Now, as I'd mentioned, there's territorial power sharing, there's consociationalism, and there are also mixed aspects of power sharing taking from each. Consociationalism is where you can have two or more ethnic or national communities existing within a single state, and the leaders of those communities cooperate through both self-government and shared government. But essentially, there might be different rights for the different communities. In the last 50 years, we've seen a few different examples of consociational elements in states, including in Canada, specifically with the Quebecois, and also the First Peoples. Lebanon, especially in the 60s and 70s, Cyprus in the 1960 Constitution, and so on. So in sum, this is to say that when we think about statehood, there are many structures and many options. There are confederal options, there are federal options, there's autonomy, there's consociationalism, and of course, there are mixed structures, which take from a little bit from a few of these, in which the leaders of a country use all of the colors in the palette to paint the picture that would work particularly for their own situation. And one thing which I did not mention, but we could talk about later in question and answer, is that for some of these places, there's also an aspect of the role of the international community in assisting with the structuring and the guarantees that are part of the constitutional structure. So in closing, what I would say is the sort of the key takeaway points here is that federalism is not an all or nothing question. It is not an issue of just having a unitary state or two different states. It is a menu of options. It's a palette of colors. And in part, what we're here to do today is to talk about the particular palette in Moldova and whether there is something that can be painted there or not in terms of federalism, so or power sharing. So with that, I'm now going to turn to introducing our discussants for this morning's panel discussion, this morning's roundtable. I will introduce them in the order that they will be speaking. And as Vlad had mentioned, we are really fortunate to have an incredible group of speakers here today, really people who are and have been at the center of many of these questions over the last 15, 20 years. So we're going to start with Ambassador Pamela Hyde-Smith. Pamela Hyde-Smith held the position of U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Moldova from 2001 to 2003. Until her retirement from the State Department in late 2005, she was a career member of the Senior Foreign Service, and she having served prior to her ambassadorship as Minister Counselor for Public Affairs at the U.S. Embassy in London, Press Attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, Cultural Attaché in Belgrade, and in her first posting at the U.S. Embassy in Bucharest, or in a first posting at the U.S. Embassy in Bucharest. She joined the Foreign Service in 1975. From 2003 to 2007, Ambassador Smith taught a course on public diplomacy, and she has also since returned to the State Department intermittently to lead inspections for the Office of the Inspector General. She serves on the boards of Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy and the Colorado Chapter of the Nature Conservancy. After Ambassador Smith, we will hear from Vladimir Sokor, who is actually sitting furthest to the left at the other end of the table. Vladimir Sokor is a senior fellow of the Washington-based Jamestown Foundation and its flagship publication, the Eurasian Daily Monitor, where he writes analytical articles on a daily basis. As an expert on the former Soviet Union and former Soviet-ruled countries in Eastern Europe, the South Caucasus, and Central Asia, he covers Russian and Western policies. He focuses on energy, regional security issues, Russian foreign affairs, secessionist conflicts, and NATO policies and programs. He's a frequent speaker at the U.S. and European policy conferences and think tank institutes, and he's been a guest lecturer at the NATO Defense College and Harvard University's National Security Program on National Security Program's Black Sea Program. After Mr. Sokor, we will hear from Ambassador William Hill. Dr. William Hill is a professor of national security strategy at the National War College in Washington, D.C. A retired Foreign Service officer, Dr. Hill is an expert on Russia and the former Soviet Union, on East-West relations, and European multilateral diplomacy. He served two terms, from January 2003 to July 2006, and also from June 1999 to November 2001, as the head of the OSCE mission to Moldova, where he was charged with negotiation of a political settlement of the Transnistrian conflict and the facilitation of the withdrawal of Russian forces, arms, and ammunition from Moldova. He was a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., and an associate of Georgetown's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy in 2006 and 2007. And as I would assume that many people here know, but he's also the author of Russia, the Near Abroad, and the West, Lessons from the Moldova-Transnistria Conflict, which is a fantastic study of the negotiations having to do with Transnistria in the early to mid-2000s. And our final speaker will be Wazu Nantoy, who is seated directly next to Ambassador Hill. Wazu Nantoy is a Moldovan political commentator, politician, journalist. He has had a varied career, starting with being a member of the Academy of Sciences in the Republic of Moldova from 1974 to 1990, where he was working in the hard sciences in physics, chemistry, and biology. And then he transitions to dealing with all these squishier political issues. And he was the deputy general director of the Moldova Press Agency from 1990 to 91. He became the head of the Department for Political Analysis for the government of the Republic of Moldova from 91-92. and has been also the head of the Department of Interdepartmental Committee of the State Policy on Transnistrian Conflict Settlement starting in 1998. And since 2000, he's been a program director, the program director for conflict management at the Institute for Public Policy. He's also the founder of the Social Democratic Party in Moldova, which he created on May 13th, 1990. He served as a member of the Parliament of Moldova from 2009 to 2010. And he was proposed as a candidate in the Moldovan presidential election in 2011, 2012, and he's an avid skydiver. With that, we have a sort of an embarrassment of riches in terms of perspectives. What we're going to do is this. This morning is really going to be organized as a discussion. So each of the panelists will begin with about a 10-minute setting out of key topics. We will then hear from Ambassador Igor Montianu, the ambassador from the Republic of Moldova to the United States, who is here with us today, who will then speak from the government's perspective. And then we will have a discussion. We'll start with a moderated discussion amongst the panelists, and we'll open things up fairly quickly to a discussion with the audience, and we'll give the panelists a chance to close things off at the end. Now, with that, we're running on sort of a tight time frame, so the last job that I have is sort of to keep time for everybody, so I will be doing that, so every so often you might hear me sort of jump in, but we have, I think, a chance for a fairly broad and deep discussion. So without any further ado, I will turn things over to Ambassador Smith.
Thank you so much, and hello, everybody. I see old friends in the audience, and I'd like to say a special hello to old friends in Moldova who might be watching via computer. Moldova is still very dear to my heart. I don't follow it as closely as I used to, but it's a delight to be here and freshen up my views a bit. I last visited Moldova in the fall of 2011, and things actually looked pretty much the same, which I took not to be the best sign in the world. But anyway, we are here to talk about federalism and Moldova, and I'm happy to do this through the prism of my time as ambassador from, as you heard, 2001 to 2003. During my time in Chisinau, the U.S. came out in favor of a federalization plan that called for some autonomy for Transnistria and Gagauzia. Now we've heard these good definitions, and I'm using federalism and autonomy in a more sort of general way. And maybe I should take your definitions and change things. But anyway, this plan preceded and was very different from the COSAC memorandum, which some people found deeply flawed and was introduced shortly after I left the country. Others more familiar with it can discuss it. But the earlier plan, which was called the Kiev document, was developed by the OSCE and, in our view, would not have given undue advantage to Russia and Transnistria, as some people claimed. It would instead have made Transnistria and Gagauzia integral parts of Moldova and subject to Moldova's laws and procedures. This plan also, though, would have given Transnistria and Gagauzia control over internal matters pertaining solely to them. But it left much to be worked out, and I like very much your metaphor of the palette of colors, because the parties will have to decide many things for themselves. The Kiev document presented these ideas under the fig leaf of similarity to the Russian constitutional model, in which a hypothetically federal system is actually largely controlled centrally by the capital. The US and the OSCE were criticized for this approach on what seemed to me some faulty grounds. Some critics hadn't looked carefully at the Kiev document and leapt to hasty conclusions based on content that was imagined. Some critics fell into the habit of assuming that there was a plot somehow against Moldova. And mostly, many Moldovans and even some knowledgeable commentators and observers tended and still tend, I think, to assume that federalism per se is a bad idea and will hurt Moldova. This assumption I don't quite understand, but it must be based in part on observation of the Russian Federation, where one can easily see that federalism and, in fact, politics overall are, in actual practice, instead of theory, neither encouraging nor inspiring. But the theory underpinning the Kiev document was useful and certainly could have been implemented differently in Moldova than similar theories or constitutional models are in Russia. In any case, the prejudice against federalism took on a life of its own, which is unfortunate. I hope people in Moldova can overcome this prejudice and look at healthy models of federalism, like the United States or Germany or Mexico, because in these cases, in practice as well as in theory, local political entities do have some power and autonomy over some sectors, local sectors, while the national government controls defense and foreign policy, major financial and trade relationships, and so on. It seems to me that power sharing or federalism or whatever we call it is really the only way that Transnistria and Gagauzia for balance can successfully be part of a whole united Moldova. The territories are too small to succeed on their own. And now Transnistria has, 22 years of history with a separate existence, which would make it very hard to incorporate into Moldova without any autonomy at all. I grant that Russia is an impediment to fashioning the right, healthy kind of federalization for Moldova, but I can't believe that that means that we should all give up trying to push for what is best. A related point. I maintain, as I have for a long time, that if Right Bank Moldova improves its political and economic sectors so successfully that it becomes a natural partner to the EU, which will increase Moldovan incomes dramatically, then the people of Transnistria won't want to be left behind and will seek some kind of reunification despite Russia. For all these reasons, the political disarray recently besetting Moldova has been particularly dangerous and troubling and has threatened Moldova's European integration aspirations. All of us who hold Moldova dear are pleased and hopeful that the new government that has been formed will help Moldova move forward and fulfill its hopes and aspirations. A little bit about the talks. You know, perhaps, that the talks restarted in 2011 with the US and the EU having observer status, thus creating the term 5+2 talks. From 11 to 2012, there were five rounds of talks establishing the way forward, but the talks got stuck in 2012 until the recent round that took place in Odessa. The US takes these talks seriously and plays an active role. Here I'm not really speaking for the US as an official because I'm retired, but I can't help but say a few words anyway, coordinating closely with the EU. US participants in the recent round included Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Dan Russell, Ambassador Will Mosier, State Department official Wendy Stancer, and a representative from our embassy in Kyiv. Our current and long-term position is based, and this I remember distinctly because it was true when I was there, on, where did I go with this? Respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Moldova. And we believe this can best be achieved if Transnistria is provided with some sort of special status. I understand that the recent 5+2 talks were difficult in many respects, but did produce at least some progress on one front, the removal of a funicular at the Rybnica plant. And I gather that there have also been some small removals of radioactive materials from Transnistria on which the two sides have cooperated. Looking at the larger picture, however, there has been very little real substantive progress in many years. For example, Transnistria and Russia have been refusing to discuss the third basket, which covers security issues, contrary to what was agreed initially. The Moldovan government recently has also been somewhat reluctant to discuss this basket. If there is to be further progress, the new Moldovan government will have to pour fresh energy into this process. Both Moldova and Transnistria will have to be flexible about some of their cherished positions, and of course all parties to the talks, including Russia, will have to contribute and compromise as well, because no one side or country can expect to achieve all of its goals. So I'll stop there and listen with great interest to my fellow panelists.
Thank you. And next we will hear from Vladimir Sokor.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's debate is a recycling of a decade-old debate. Even the protagonists of that debate are being recycled for today's panel, because what we are seeing in this panel are the protagonists of that debate that has never stopped since 2002, when the so-called Kiev document was proposed to federalize the Republic of Moldova. Professor Borgen has reviewed for us the wide range of theoretical options by which federalization schemes might be implemented. It is practically an infinite range of theoretical options. And this is why, at many points in time, the debate about federalizing Moldova has become a topic of political science, comparative law, comparative constitutional law, comparative government, and so on. Academic debates have tended to hijack the debates about the political federalization of Moldova. Oftentimes, the discussions took on the form of political science seminars. Numerous foreign travels, junkets I would call them, were organized for the Tiraspol authorities to persuade them of the benefits of various conflict resolution models ranging from Northern Ireland or Finland's Åland Islands all the way to Sudan or Indonesia's East Timor. All of these examples were being invoked by Tiraspol as pretexts to drag on the negotiations or not to negotiate at all, to divert the negotiations into false paths. In reality, the debate about federalizing the Republic of Moldova is a purely political matter. It is a matter of the correlation of political forces at any given stage on the international level, on the regional level, and on the internal Moldovan level. It is all a matter of the correlation of forces politically, militarily, and with respect to civil aspects, such as, in the case of Moldova, corruption arrangements, which decisively shape the political and constitutional arrangements within Moldova. Let me review those three levels of political levels, which defined and continue to define the debate about federalization. First, the international, you might say almost the global level. For some reason in 2002, the issue of federalizing Moldova became a matter of US foreign policy. I don't know why, and I don't know why at that very point in time. But I can recount for you the events around the OSCE's 2002 year-end conference at Porto, when the following changes were made to the 1999 Istanbul commitments. Under a formula jointly agreed by the United States and Russia and imposed by the United States on the Moldovan delegation at the conference, Russia's 1999 commitment to withdraw the troops was reformulated as an intention rather than a commitment. A one-year extension of the time period was granted, and the conditionality to the withdrawal of troops was introduced, which was absent from the 1999 Istanbul commitments, namely, Russia would withdraw the troops when, quote, the necessary conditions are in place, unquote. The Russian delegation at the conference tried to persuade the Moldovan delegation to accept this. The Moldovan delegation rejected it, and it was then imposed on the Moldovan delegations by the U.S. delegation in a scene that unfolded within the eyesight of the Russian delegation at the conference. In other words, Moldova had become an object in a wider bargaining. I don't know why, but December 2002 was the time when the United States was trying very hard to obtain Russian approval in the UN Security Council for the operation in Iraq. Is there a connection? Maybe it's just a coincidence of timing. The United States, from that point on, took the lead in promoting the federalization of Moldova via the US-led OSCE mission in Chisinau. The US support, government support, was clearly in the background. We just heard from Ambassador Smith that this was US policy, but it was implemented via an international organization, the OSCE. Federalization was presented at the time as a means of securing the withdrawal of Russian troops from Moldova, part of a package deal, again departing from the 1999 Istanbul commitments, which stipulated no such conditionality or no conditionality of any kind. So the international context was unfavorable for implementing any kind of such a solution to Moldova. The United States was not a participant in the international negotiations, which are now known as 5+2. The United States entered those negotiations alongside the European Union only in 2005, and only as an observer. On the regional plane, Russian troops were entrenched in Moldova at the time, deeply entrenched. Ukraine did not have any kind of definite policy toward Moldova. Under existing arrangements at that time, Ukraine was a so-called guarantor of an eventual settlement alongside with Russia. The only international presence in this setup was the OSCE. But the OSCE is internally restricted by Russia's veto within the organization. The OSCE cannot even adopt resolutions, let alone enforce resolutions, without prior agreement with Russia inside the organization on the consensus principle, a euphemism for the Russian veto. When federalization was proposed in 2002, my own reaction was Finnish Moldavia. Moldova would have ceased to exist as a functioning state. Power sharing with Transnistria would have involved certain rights for the representatives of Transnistria to influence the decisions of the central government in Chisinau. You have to keep in mind this difference between genuine federalism and the kind of federalism that the Russian and Transnistrian side insisted upon, namely that as part of this arrangement, Transnistria should not only enjoy internal autonomy, but have a say in the decisions of the central government in Chisinau. This, of course, would have prevented Moldova from ever going west, which, at the time when federalization was proposed in 2002-2003, was not yet an option for Moldova. Federalism would have played a preventative role in stopping Moldova from going west, which, I repeat, at the time was not yet an option. That became an option a few years later. I believed in 2004, that any kind of settlement of Transnistria conflict, whether federalization or in any form, should await a more favorable international context, which, as I naively believed at that time, would involve the victory of the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, the reorientation of Ukraine unambiguously towards the West.
2 minutes.
Deeper NATO commitment in the countries to the east of NATO and the European Union, and so on. Of course, none of this occurred. The international context, the regional context, did not improve. And now on the local level. Moldova would never have been able to sustain a federal system given the existing circumstances of power in Moldova. It is sad to invoke Moldova's own weaknesses, internal weaknesses, as an argument against federalism. But this is a reality. Moldova's institutional setup, its political system, its political parties, could never have survived federalization with Transnistria. What would have prevailed would not have been any kind of arrangement that would have been reached on paper. What would have prevailed would have been informal arrangements among Moldova's political forces, Tiraspol's representatives, all under the supervision of Russia, which would have had its own agents inside Moldova's political forces and political system. And finally, beyond federalization, we should look at the potential for what I have called cantonalization of Moldova. In the event, cantonalization, division into cantons, local cantons, canton-type entities, if federalization would have been imposed or is imposed, theoretically speaking, in the near future, then you will surely see demands for local autonomy in the form of some kind of canton-type entities in the predominantly Russian-speaking city of Belzi, in the predominantly Bulgarian-inhabited district of Taraklia, in at least parts of Ukrainian-speaking districts in the northeast of Moldova, and you will also see a demand from the Gagauz leadership for co-equal status with Transnistria within a federalized Moldova. The Gagauz leaders of in both rival camps in Gagauzia, they are all saying that in the event that Transnistria receives a federal status, Gagauzia would seek the same status. And you see the same tendencies already at present in Belzi and in Taraklia, tendencies which were not yet in evidence 10 or 5 or even 3 years ago. And so this is why I think federalization would be Finnish Moldavia in the present circumstances, just as it would have been 10 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And next we'll hear from Ambassador William Hill.
Okay, thanks very much. Well, I'd first like to thank Vlad Spino and Jonas Rolat for organizing this, the Moldova Foundation, Open Society Institute, and you know, my fellow panelists for the chance to have an interesting discussion. You know, whether it is back to the future, we will see. And I need to say two things. First of all, that I'm speaking here in my personal capacity, and my remarks do not reflect the views of the National War College, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. And if you're watching in Kiev, hello. In any case, the question of federalization or federalism in Moldova actually goes back further than 2002. At the time of the ceasefire, the military part of the conflict was signed on July 21st, 1992. And discussions began almost immediately. There was a failed approach that summer of the Moldovans to the CSCE, to the UN, which were too busy to respond. But a process of how the two banks of the river would coexist was launched almost immediately. Now, I'd like to say two things about how I understand the general parameters of the conflict. There was a conflict, clearly, between Moldova and Russia, which goes on, that began before there was an independent Moldova, with an effort of certain elements of in the Soviet Union to fight Gorbachev's Union Treaty and keep Moldova within the USSR. There is also a local conflict between the inhabitants of the right and the left bank. And if one ignores either the larger conflict or the more local conflict, I believe one is mistaken and will have a lesser chance of reaching a settlement of and peace and stability in the region overall. The other thing is that the conflict between the left and right bank involved not simply ethnicity, language, rights of education in which language, but also important questions of property and jobs that cut across national, ethnic, and linguistic lines and are often unrecognized. Now, the history of attempts at conflict resolution and discussion of power sharing began almost immediately. At that time, senior Polish diplomat Adam Rotfeld was sent by the CSCE chair to Moldova, Transnistria in the winter of 92-93. Adam went, December of 92. His report was available formally in early 1993. And he reached the conclusion that some sort of power sharing between the right and left bank was going to be necessary for a solution to be reached. The CSCE then entered the fold, the mission mandate. The CSCE adopted a mandate to send the mission to Moldova in February of 1993. The mission was deployed in April of 1993, spent some 6 months talking to parties throughout the country, both banks. And really, the seminal report in the OSCE activity is report number 13, issued in November of 1993, that made a couple of key points that have really been the basis of international involvement by other nations and international organizations, as well as the OSCE since then. The first one is that Transnistria should have some sort of special political status within a unified Moldovan state. One state, special status. Second conclusion was that solutions that tend towards the end of the spectrum that Chris Borgen was describing, either a unitary state or a confederation, solutions that involve these kinds of constructs were likely not to be acceptable and likely not to work. All sorts within that conclusion, specifics of the arrangement of power and status, power sharing and status for Transnistria within Moldova were not specified, and there was widespread debate. When I arrived in Moldova, I searched in my files and I found that 1993 and 94, while there were discussions going on within the country about the nature of the new Moldovan constitution and the Gagauz statute, all sorts of solutions were discussed. The OSCE sponsored a large conference for Moldovans and some international representatives. At that time, one afternoon session was devoted to possible federal solutions. Will surprise no one that was the stormiest session of the conference, where people, according to the written account, people literally nearly came to blows because the idea of a federation was so controversial within Moldova. Why is it controversial? Well, because the academic question, as Vladimir Sokor has pointed out, the academic question of how to organize the territorial units or territorial parts of the country and the government structure is deeply political, not only local, but international. And certain types of organization are associated with certain external actors, in particular Russia. And the terms used, federalism, confederation, unitary state, unitarism, associated either with Russian domination or, on the Romanian side, Reunire. When in trouble, the Transnistrians and the Russians wave the tricolor and use that stalking horse. So the discussion has been colored from the very beginning with these political backgrounds to the dispute within Moldova, and attempts at finding some sort of special status for Transnistria have generally run aground on this. The Moscow Memorandum basically proposes that, or negotiated by Primakov in 96, signed in 97, specifies that the two parties, Chisinau and Tiraspol, will organize their relations within the framework of a common state. When Westerners read this, you know, from coming in from outside, we look, oh, one state, it'll be reunified. You know, the Moldovans, many of them, Chisinau, looked at the Obshchoe Gosudarstvo and saw this as an instrument for outside penetration and domination of the Russian government. Attempts to specify what was meant by the common state and the special status for Transnistria quickly ran aground. In 2000, the OSCE mission and the Ukrainians, I consider the Ukrainians an international presence in Moldova, although, you know, perhaps not wholly international, but yeah, I think they are. Anyway, we organized in Kiev a working table, invited experts from the Venice Commission, the United States, as well as CIS countries, and split them up. The CIS guys worked in one panel. The Westerners, U.S. and Venice Commission, worked in another. The Western solution basically built a status for Transnistria that looked very much like a federation, except that they didn't use the word. Brought the results back, showed it to the Transnistrians and the Moldovans. Neither side was interested. It came, though. The seed had apparently been planted. Yeah, while I was there in my first term, I asked both the Transnistrians and the Moldovans, well, have you ever thought of having a federation? And I got various answers. In private, not wholly hostile. You know, the Transnistrians in private, at least a couple of them, expressed amazement the Russians had not yet proposed some sort of federation, given that Russia was allegedly a federation itself. Well, it's a federation in name, but less and less in reality these days. Moldovans considered it. In 2001, by the time I left, you know, President Voronin was not willing to take such a step. But by 2002, he was. And, you know, without going into the details, I was not there at the time, Ambassador Smith was, but I know something about it. But some of those same Venice Commission experts and representatives of Moldovan government were key actors in developing the Kiev document.
Yes.
The impetus came from within as well as from without. The Kiev document and the process of negotiation after it fell apart on the basis of Transnistrian and Russian rethinking, but President Voronin came up with a constitutional initiative. It's his proposal that he made first to me and Adrian Yakubovits in January of 2003 to rewrite the Moldovan constitution as a federal document in conjunction with Transnistria and make a federal solution. He also went to Vladimir Putin for help on this. Vladimir Putin eventually gave him Dmitry Nikolaevich Kozak. The processes began together in 2003 and split. And if you look at the results of them, despite efforts to keep them together, they went apart. They went for the Kozak Memorandum, which we ended up stating, that those of us that did the mediator's document, that we could not accept. The experience basically soured the country for a long time on using federalism as a means of describing power sharing within the country. And attempts had been made, but actions were taken, in my view, Moldova's passage of the 2005 law and the 2006 Transnistrian referendum set the two parties on courses that have basically made it impossible in the 5+2 talks since 2006 to talk about anything but really operational issues between the two parties to the conflict, and not at all about status. So where we end, and I'm ending right now, Chris, the essential questions remain. How much power, in which branches of government, and in what form might Chisinau share power with Tiraspol? Second, what guarantees offer by whom and in what form? What guarantees will there be that the rules of the game of this power-sharing arrangement cannot be changed after a settlement? I can only hardly endorse Ambassador Smith's view that if the right bank, in the current circumstances, is successful in promulgating reforms that bring it closer to the EU and making it more attractive, it will have enormous effect on bringing Transnistria along and provide enormous impulse for resolution of the conflict, despite opposition from the Northeast. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, we will hear from Wazu Nantoy, closing off this first part of the discussion.
Thank you. 10 years ago, I didn't need this.
Nor I.
I am very glad to be here among the friends of Moldova. Thanks for people who organized my trip. But also, I have some trouble with my English, and please accept my language, and maybe my taking into account this reason for me will be more will be difficult to be so diplomatic like my colleagues. Okay, I think that any more or less serious discussion should start with. By some definitions. And before discussing a brilliant theoretical approach like our friends Chris Borgen presented, it's very important to know the essence of the processes on the both banks of Nistria. What does mean Transnistria? Look please at the map. It's an extremely narrow strip of land between Ukraine and the rest of the territories of the Republic of Moldova. We are very happy that Transnistria has not a common border with Russia, like South Ossetia and Abkhazia. It's a condition for frozenness of the conflict. Area of this narrow strip of land, it's nearly 3,700 square kilometers. Population is under 500,000. People are actively living from Transnistria. I have the information that nearly 150 families each week are living from this depressive region. People are tired to live in this area in the conditions of the lack of democracy without any perspective for existing of this region. In Transnistria, there are 137,000 of pensioners. Each pensioner received each month an amount nearly $10 directly from Russian Federation. It's another condition for stability of this regime. And for one person, there are 0.75 employees in local economy. Budget deficit is nearly 70%, and the Transnistria has a debt of nearly $4.5 billion for consumed Russian gas. People and economical agents from Left Bank of Nistria, they are paying money for consumed gas. This money are accumulated for separate account in the bank and are used for compensation of this huge deficit budget. This money are not going to Gazprom. And in this way, Russia directly financed this regime, and in parallel, this became a headache for the Republic of Moldova, this huge debt. The essence of the political regime, in my personal opinion, is an authoritarian and xenophobic regime. And the main conclusion is that the local administration does not represent the population from Left Bank of Nistria. Traditionally, they are Russian puppets at the in the negotiation process also. In Transnistria, there is a very interesting picture of the citizenship. Nearly people are looking for citizenship of some real state. More than 60% of people from Left Bank of Nistria, they have Moldovan citizenship. They are Moldovan citizens who act like me. Also, Russia tries to spread widely the Russian passports. The idea is very simple. Russia wants to declare in some time that this territory is populated mainly by Russian citizens, so goodbye Moldova. And Ukraine also tries to promote the similar policy in generous manner also offer the Ukrainian passports for ethnic Ukrainians from left bank of Dniester. Last time, I observed a funny process. On the left bank of Dniester, there is a village Parkane, the biggest village populated by ethnic Bulgarians out of the Bulgarian territory. And Bulgarian embassy last year started to deliver the European Union citizenship, Bulgarian citizenship for population from these people from left bank of Dniester in so-called Transnistria. Okay. It's a strange conflict because we have business. All economical agents from left bank of Dniester are registered in the right bank and received from our custom department and documents for exports of the goods from Moldova and on the European Union market also. European economical agents from Transnistria export more goods on the European Union market than from right bank of Dniester. And now I have information that economical agents from Transnistria have some hopes in connection with the signing of the association of agreement with association with the European Union, especially deep and comprehensive free trade agreement. They want to have the possibility to make business in the European Union, and this position of local business is in clear conflict with Russian policy and the local administration policy. More than 4,000 young people from left bank of Dniester, they are students in Chisinau. In some institutions, there are whole groups by students from left bank of Dniester. We have a common sports championship in some sport disciplines, soccer, and so on. So it's not a frozen conflict. It's a conflict with frozen solution, with artificially, intentionally frozen solution. It's my opinion. In the so-called Transnistrian Moldovan Republic Act 8 school, under the curricula of the Republic of Moldova, in Tiraspol also. And this school not only acts in the Romanian language, but this school prepares Moldovan citizens in the core of the so-called Transnistrian Republic. And last but not least, on left bank of Dniester, in so-called Transnistria, there are 11 villages under the Moldovan jurisdiction, so-called Dubasari Raion. Population from these villages defended their right to be under the Moldovan jurisdiction, being in the fight with Russian troops, Russian Cossacks. It's the beginning of the conflict. And I want to make some remark, Mr. Hill. At the beginning, conflict arose not between left and right bank of Dniester. Conflict arose in interior of left bank of Dniester, between people who defended the sovereignty of the Republic of Moldova and their territorial integrity, and people who were manipulated by separatist idea. And now I want to propose the definition. What does mean Transnistrian conflict? Transnistrian conflict is, in my opinion, is a conflict between the Republic of Moldova's state-building project within the border of the former Moldavian Soviet Socialist Republic and the new imperial ambitions of the Russian Federation. The Russian Federation illegally maintains its troops on the territory of the Republic of Moldova, being the only state that defies the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and the status of neutrality of the Republic of Moldova. I also want to add that at the beginning of the conflict, the more than 25,000 of people from left bank of Dniester became an internally displaced person. In the reality was realized the policy of ethnic cleaning on left bank of Dniester. about the essence of this regime. Being a real part in the conflict, Russian Federation created and strengthened as a tool an authoritarian regime on the part of the territory of the Republic of Moldova. Russian Federation, public and private capital, has privatized in obviously illegal manner a number of strategic assets on the territory of the Republic of Moldova in Transnistria. About Transnistrian debts that were already mentioned. Taking into account this information about Left Bank of and my personal vision about the definition of the conflict, my conclusion is that Transnistria is not a side in the conflict. If conflict is between the Republic of Moldova and Russia, really, it's a question for me why the internal organization of one side of the conflict could become a solution of the conflict in the essence. The notions viable solution for Transnistrian regime, for Transnistrian conflict, means a procedure of integration of the population in the eastern district of the Republic of Moldova, combined with post-conflict internal organization of the Republic of Moldova, that will ensure optimal condition for the successful consolidation of the Moldovan civic nation, and at the same time will not allow in the future in any form the revival of separatist tendencies, especially a revival triggered from abroad. The viable solutions to the Transnistrian conflict can only be imposed in the eastern districts of the Republic of Moldova by implementing a roadmap developed by the government of the Republic of Moldova. The viable solution requires unconditional dismantling of the Transnistrian Moldovan Republic structures and the termination of the illegal Russian military presence on the territory of the Republic of Moldova. The territory of the left bank of Dniester River has to be distributed, taking into the consideration geographical economical criteria, between several second-level territorial administrative units created under a new territorial administrative reform of the reunified Republic of Moldova. The administrative center of these new territorial units, except Tiraspol, should be located on the right bank of Dniester. Look, please, on the map, why the Ryan center from northern side of Transnistria, Kamenka, should be subordinated to Tiraspol. I don't understand why Rezina and Rybnica, two cities on the both face-to-face on both banks of Dniester, should be divided. Maybe it's more rational to create some similar Budapest. Why we should divide?
Well, you're about time.
Okay. About time. I see only one person from Moldova. I should have, and I am not diplomatic.
You'll have plenty of other chances to talk. Don't
worry. Okay. The alleged specificity of Transnistria in the relation of the right bank to the right bank of Dniester, great Russian chauvinism, Romanophobia, the lack of democratic experience, organized crime, cannot serve as a basis for any special legal status. It's my opinion as a citizen of the Republic of Moldova. And should be dismantled during the transition period by implementing the provisions of the roadmap, including illustration law. The viable solution to the Transnistrian conflict can be achieved only if on the both banks of Dniester River, the consequences of the communist Soviet past will be dismantled. We on the right bank of Dniester should dismantle communists, and people, de-transnistrization should be implemented on the left bank of Dniester, just as Germany, after the Second World War, went through a process of denazification. It's my personal opinion. Okay, free movement of persons, goods, and services.
We're going to have to jump because there is one other person from Moldova, the ambassador.
Free movement of persons, goods, and services will sharply accelerate the restoring of the multidimensional communication between the people on both banks of Dniester River and will prove the absence of any internal conflict. I have to speak a lot, but I want to conclude that I'm not being the United States. I cannot be against the federative model. I like German federative model, Austrian, less like Russian Federation. But in any case, for us, for my country, it's not a priority to discuss a post-conflict organization of the state. For us, it's a priority to settle the conflict. And I'm deeply convinced that free citizens of free country without illegal presence of foreign troops will be able to decide about the optimum internal organization of this country, federation, wide autonomy, or even unitary state, why not? But free citizen of free country, it's a key condition. And after that, we will invite you and we will discuss in any in other situation.
Okay, thank you, Watson. So with that, we will turn things over to, as I mentioned, to the other Moldovan in the room, Ambassador Igor Muntianu, who is the ambassador from Moldova to the United States, who has graciously accepted to come and speak for a few minutes to speak about the point of view from the government of Moldova on these various questions that we've been talking about this morning. Ambassador,
please. Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak on behalf of my embassy and the government. This is a topic that deserves a lot of attention, and I will start by presenting my sincere appreciation to the Moldova Foundation and to the Open Society Institute, which are really and consistently spreading out the message about the real content of this conflict in Moldova, not only the historical overview, but also the real and feasible solutions that would integrate or reintegrate the country. As you could remark from the speeches that have been presented, there are old protagonists, old views, and also new approaches, and particularly this kind of venues are extremely important to make a bridge between the academia, also the public personalities that have created visibility and sensibility towards the conflict resolution in our part of the world, and also the decision makers. And I'm sure that the suggestions will go to the decision makers. What is important also to stress is that I do not have the luxury of Ambassador Hill to speak on my behalf or Ambassador Pamela Smith. I have to go along the lines that are very important for my government. And in this regard, I will just go through the red lines for the directions that are very important for us. First of all, the conflict should be resolved according and settled exclusively by peaceful means, and that is very important. And the 5+2 talks, this is the one international agreed mechanism that could lead to a comprehensive and long-lasting solution. Final goal of the negotiations is to achieve a comprehensive and viable solution for the reintegration of Transnistria into the body of the Moldovan state within its internationally recognized borders. A special status for this region shall be based on the respect of territorial unity, integrity, sovereignty, unity of the nation, providing substantial and comfortable level of self-governance for the region. Final settlement must lead to the consolidation of a functional, democratic, independent and sovereign state by restoring the single constitutional, economical, security and defense space of Moldova. Finally, reintegration of Moldova should be consistent and bring no prejudice to the strategical orientation of Moldova towards European integration, whereas signing an association agreement with the European Union is a vital step towards Moldova membership into the EU. What are the obstacles to this process? The list is long. But one of the main painful is a certain proclivity of our counterparts, and I will emphasize counterparts in Tiraspol, to read the 5+2 talks only as an invitation to extort new concessions and more time until they hope the two-state, two geopolitical orientations formula might emerge as the hammered solution. And now, Turner, we are keen to promote a rapprochement that is based on the primacy of law, inclusive and democratic institutions, human rights, but will back off any attempts to build up more separation more twist of arms and more hate speech in this region of Moldova. Another hurdle in the equation is a certain value gap between mediators and observers. One mediator is very pleased with the current status quo and is strongly objecting against the third basket, political and security issues of the negotiations. Also, the same mediator is further supplying the Raspol administration with more than generous cash bonuses, cheap gas, inflamed populist rhetoric, and military assistance, which is clearly at odds with the proclaimed aims of reaching out a peaceful conflict settlement. We contemplate a strong opposition of the Russian Transnistrian representatives to admit any serious talks on political and security issues, while preferring instead fishing for unilateral concessions from Chisinau on issues of exclusive rights or the so-called implicit statehood. Most of the obstacles today emerge from the tactical bickering or even massive provocations instead of goodwill response, and I would call here Varnitsa incident and also the shutdown of several units belonging to Moldova in Bender city. This will not force us to renounce to the small steps approach, because Moldova has a direct responsibility towards its people. We have 350,000 citizens of Moldova, and nobody can be politically responsible to detach these citizens from the body of the constitutional responsibility of Moldova. But this will not make us to accept any sort of dictate aimed to kill and bury a long-lasting, durable, and democratic solution to the conflict. We may agree or may disagree on several subjects: car, railway transportation, free movement, external trade, education, but this cannot obfuscate the ultimate aim of the settlement, which is partially enshrined in the mandate of the OSCE mission in Moldova, I remember probably February 1993, to facilitate the achievement of a lasting, comprehensive political settlement of Transnistrian conflict, consolidating the independence and sovereignty of Moldova within an understanding about a special status for the region. We fully agree with that. All mediation observation efforts must lead to the reintegration of this region into Moldovan state, which shall remain sovereign, united, and indivisible. And of course, we need more international support, democratic self-confidence, and creative minds to foster human rights and primacy of international law upon short-sighted bargaining. The way forward, how we can look at the way forward. Moving towards the third basket is of vital importance to us, to all of us. Joint efforts of mediators and observers, along further progress in dialogue of the sides in negotiations, will bring us closer to a fair settlement whose roadmap may be influenced by two elements. One is the source, and the second is the authority of the final mediation. First, which will be the source of the new comprehensive proposal of the political settlement? It can be either one of the sides to the conflict. But the risk in this case will be that any variant will be rejected by the other side. Second, it can be proposed by one of the international actors, a mediator or an observer, in 2005 Ukrainian Yushchenko plan, or OCC chairmanship in 2006 Belgian mandate. Or third, it can be a proposal on behalf of several mediators, observers, like in 2004 OCC.
The second, which might be the level of details of this plan?
It can be a detailed plan or a general framework document stating basic principles of the settlement. I personally think that a document proposed or at least suggested by the largest number of international participants will get more chances to be seen as a platform for future negotiations and build up. But will the mediators and observers be able to agree today on a joint document? Recently, President of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, has recently stated in Ekaterinburg that we need a comprehensive settlement of the Transnistrian conflict. Basic principles for a future settlement should be agreed now. This is a conflict which can be solved. We certainly hope that the USA high-level representatives could also be able to engage and pursue a strategic commitment to the conflict settlement based on the principles that it always supported for Moldova: territorial integrity, sovereignty, unity, within in international borders. And this means full and unconditional withdrawal of the Russian troops from the territory. That's clear. Considering a long break in negotiations, in negotiating potential status, a more general document outlining basic parameters of the solution probably would be more acceptable. But here one should decide how to navigate towards a new start, avoiding new hostilities that may undercut attempts to, let's say, any further rapprochement. Some others are fully discredited in Moldova, such as the attempts to impose a federal model like in 2003 was the story of the Cossack Memorandum. We believe that it is better to avoid attributing future solution to a concrete model. Instead of looking at a particular model of practical settlement, we should focus on the substantive elements of the settlement, which may comprise, inter alia, the following. The first element is competence distribution between central and regional authorities. Absolutely clear, basic attributes of the state must be enshrined to the central government, including foreign and security policy, defense, customs, border control, currency, national taxation. Some forms of power sharing and consultation of regional bodies might be envisaged, but ultimate sovereign decisions need to be located at the core of the national authorities. Regional competencies need to be tailored to the regional authorities or managed jointly without prejudice to the constitutional provisions, granting unified implementation of laws. The second element would be related to the institutions, which means the power to rule at the national and the regional level. We certainly believe that, as any other special region, Transnistria can have its own legislative and executive bodies heavily integrated into the state authorities, with well-defined fields of competence and limits, mechanisms to be represented by the central government, electoral rules, checks and balances, as well as undisputed constitutional oversight under the authority of the Moldovan constitution. And here I would like to point, we are not reinventing the Moldovan state. We have to discuss the special status for the region of Transnistria. And finally, the third element, guarantees for bona fide implementation. They are fundamental. We believe that guarantees must be established through domestic national laws and several areas of interaction between regional, local, and national authorities. We admit also that some international soft power guarantees could be offered by some international organizations at this stage for the transitional phase. Summing up, our suggestion is to start thinking about the three elements mentioned above. Common approaches on behalf of the mediators and the observers are extremely important, and I really applaud the organization of this event in Washington. Thank you very much.
Hey, from this point, we'll move to sort of question and answer and discussion. Now, since we're sort of we have about a half an hour left, what I'll do is start going directly into discussion with the panelists, but have it immediately open to the audience. So, if you have a question as well, you should just raise your hand, and at a time that sort of works, I'll recognize you so that you can ask your question to the panelists. Do they need to? Does the audience need to speak into the microphone when they ask the question? So Vlad has microphones, so before you ask the question, just and as does Adna, just wait until the microphone is brought to you. So I will, and Ambassador Muntiano, will you be taking questions as well? And Ambassador Muntiano will also be available for questions as well. So with that, I'll start with the one question, tossing it out, really two questions, twinned in a way. One to Ambassador Hill and one to Vladimir Sokolor, having to do with each of their sort of discussions of federalism. And I'll use this as a way to sort of just start the discussion. So to Ambassador Hill, the question I would have to you is, one of the things that we've been talking about today is the question in terms of whether or not Moldovans want a federal power structure, whether or some type of power-sharing agreement. But I want to focus on sort of the population that we hadn't talked about as much in terms of whether or not they would want a structure like this, and that's the population in Transnistria. So the question I would have for you is this, is if the population in Transnistria does not want some to be reintegrated into some type of federal structure, whatever that would be. What is your views in terms of that? Is this something that you think can be sort of told to them that this is what must be done? Do you think that this would be a problem? The sort of the question is of how much of this is something that would be imposed or not. So I would put that as a question in terms of you. To Vladimir Sokor, the question that I have is sort of a flip of the question that I asked to Ambassador Hill, and it's this. In a certain amount of your discussions as to the problems of federalism in Moldova or of power sharing, you described a lot of the background politics of saying, well, these ideas of federalism are being brought up due to sort of a certain alignment of interests or the reality of politics at the time, to which one could say what you're describing is the sausage making of politics. It's never particularly pretty or pleasant. It is what it is. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the result might not be a good one. So the question that I would have to you is this. Is there a problem with federalism or power sharing in and of itself? Or has your concern been about how those proposals have come up in the past and maybe how some of them have looked in the past, particularly the Kozak Memorandum, which a lot of this seemed to revolve around, which gave a lot of power to Transnistria. So the question I have to you is sort of, are you in part focusing on the wrong thing, the sausage making, as opposed to whether or not at the end of the day a sausage might be something that would be a good thing to have? So with that, I'll turn that to each of you in terms of your reaction. So Ambassador Hill?
Well, mediators document the approach that we worked on through 2003 into 2004. And the original Yushchenko plan both called for referenda to be conducted in terms of the mediators' documents throughout the whole country, left and right bank on the proposal embodied there, the Yushchenko plan on more limited portions of a proposed solution. But this was to be an internationally, if not conducted, heavily monitored so that it would be fully transparent and believable to outside parties. So the answer basically, I think, is no. There was going to be, we did not envision an imposed solution and were fully cognizant of the need to explain and receive support not only from the political elites, but in the end from the broader population for the results of negotiations that might have gone on in a more narrow circle, how you ended up doing that. But it definitely, both plans in that sense called for a fully monitored, transparent election on the final product of a settlement.
Vladimir? And then I'll come back around to you, Wazoo, in a moment.
Right. Moldova, by which we mean those parts of the Moldovan civil society as well as the government that were involved in this debate, did not have a problem merely with the process of arriving at a federal-type settlement. It had and continues to have a problem with the intended result itself, because the intended result would have been to empower the representatives of Russia sitting in Tiraspol to participate in the decisions of the central Moldovan government. This would have been the essence of what was being proposed. Again, this would have been a preventative way at that time to stop Moldova from going west. Moldova started going west only several years later. There was impaneled a constitutional commission to rewrite Moldova's constitution, made up of three legal specialists from Chisinau and three from Transnistria. In retrospect, it seems simply monstrous to rewrite Moldova's constitution on a joint basis with Russia's representatives in Tiraspol. Those three delegates from Tiraspol were delegated by the local appointees of the Russian Federation, the leadership at that time under Igor Smirnov. Today's leadership in Tiraspol is no better than Smirnov's group in this regard. The new leader, Yevgeny Shevchuk, and his team are making frequent statements saying that they want to go east and emphasizing this contrast between Tiraspol's policy and Moldova's policy. Any power-sharing arrangement with such representatives would turn Moldova into a totally dysfunctional state, giving Russia's local representatives veto powers, at the very least, a voice, most likely a veto, in the deliberations of the Chisinau government. This is why Moldova has a problem with any type of federal solution of this type. And moreover, Moldovans are very disturbed to see that that academic talk or diplomatic negotiations about reorganizing Moldova are proceeding without a solution to the presence of Russian troops in Moldova. In other words, the negotiations are being carried out under the gun of Russian troops in Moldova. This is seen by many in Moldova as evidence of Western weakness, of discussing a reorganization of the Moldovan state in ways that would be to the advantage of Russia, without at the same time seeking to terminate Russia's military presence, which Western diplomacy is unwilling to challenge due to other priorities of the West at this stage. As long as this situation continues, Moldova will have a problem with federalizing the country. Thank you.
And so first, I know that Wazoo had said that he had one comment. Ambassador Smith, I'll see if you do as well, and then I'll come around to questions from the audience. Wazoo, did you have something that you want to add briefly?
Short comment. I hear that the last parliamentary election in Russian Federation, Party Edina Russia in Chechnya received more than 100 persons. The similar situation was on 17th of September 2006 in so-called Transnistria when was organized the referendum. It's a nonsense to entitle this movie as a referendum like in democratic country. Because, for example, our institute last year had the intention plan to realize sociological study on left bank of Dniester. And we were informed that questionnaire should be preliminary approved by KGB. People in the left bank of Dniester, they are living in an atmosphere of fear. We should liberate these people. We should democratize this region. And after that, after the open, sincere dialogue with people, between people from both bank of Dniester, we will decide about our internal organization of country. It could be federation, but for the beginning, we cannot ignore the essence of the situation of left bank of Dniester. Sorry.
Ambassador Smith.
Yes, just a couple of words about the United States and Russia. I think that it is inevitable that two large countries that have interests all over the world are going to have a lot to say to each other about a lot of topics. And that, frustrating though it may be to us in this room, Moldova is not going to be in the top five, much as we might try to put it there from time to time. So that is a fact of life that we just have to live with. But the imputing to the United States nefarious or conspiratorial roles vis-a-vis Moldova bothers me because I think the United States has been Moldova's best friend for a long time. And we have proven that in a number of ways and are continuing to do so and will in the future.
So I saw a few hands being to go up. Yes.
My name is Margarita Asanova from the Jamestown Foundation, and I have a question for Ambassador Smith and Ambassador Hill. Assuming that closeness to the European Union is going to eventually drag Transnistria closer to Moldova.
It's going to what? I'm sorry.
You said that if Moldova gets closer to the European Union, eventually a member of the European Union, who knows, or at least association agreement, this is going to bring Transnistria closer to the European Union too. We do assume that it's a good thing, that everybody wants to be closer to the European Union, that this is really what the entire region is aspiring to. But that might not be, and certainly it's not, in line with the interest of the leadership in Tiraspol. This is not only close to Russia, our Russia-appointed leadership, but this is a leadership that is benefiting from illicit economy, through criminal economy that doesn't comply with rules. Closeness to European Union means more rules, more regulations, more taxes paid, less avoidance of taxes, piracy, and so on, compliance. So how is it possible that we think that this closeness to European Union is going to bring Tiraspol closer to Moldova, closer to Chisinau, follow the path, to the good path to Brussels?
You want me to?
Well, I'll just say a couple things. It seems to me that the so-called government of Transnistria probably will not ever share that view. But I was talking more about the people of Transnistria. It was fascinating to hear Mr. Nantoi describe the emigration, the outflow of people from Transnistria. I didn't know the numbers were that big, but that gives strength to the idea that if Right Bank Moldova were much more prosperous and also linked with the EU, that those people would want to just cross the river and be in Moldova or find a way to reunify.
If you look at some of the real economic statistics beyond the slogans, you find that Transnistria for a long time had a number of large enterprises whose market was largely in the West, in the European Union. During the 1990s and well into the 2000s, Moldova Right Bank sold more goods to Russia and the CIS, while Transnistrian exports were a majority to European Union countries. Steel to construction industries in Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Southern Europe. Textiles and shoes throughout the European Union. Wines and cognacs and other things. So there has been a large economy in the Transnistrian region that was illegal simply because it was trading out of an unrecognized entity, and any trade coming out of there was called contraband. There are large illegal trade flows going through there, alcohol, tobacco, trafficking in persons. Unfortunately, this comes from criminal groups that operate both on the left and right bank right now. And you know, and throughout the region, stuff starts in Turkey, goes through Ukraine, goes through Transnistria and Moldova, and reaches the European Union. And trade flows in persons, well documented. You can read what's available in open source and U.S. government reports up, you know, through Moldova and Transnistria, up through Ukraine and Russia, and then to the Middle East. It's really tragic, but there is a large, you know, basic economy. There was. In Transnistria, that was based on export, you know, specifically to the West. Since the global economic crisis of 2008, that export, in particular the steel exports, because with the fall in commodity prices and steel prices, the Transnistrian, you know, semi-legal economy has suffered disproportionately to the Moldovan right bank economy. And what Moldova and Transnistria now share economically is a massive out-migration of young labor that sends remittances home. So the lights are out in Moldovan villages. If you travel outside of Chisinau around, you see villages deserted. You get the same thing if you go to the small towns and villages in Transnistria. You see nobody there because the adults are all working in Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, Romania, Italy, Iberia, and elsewhere. And this is what we hope. And no, I don't maintain an optimistic view of appealing to the political elites and the government in Transnistria, but to that very large, what I think is a majority in the population in Transnistria on the left bank, that engages in these you know, some very good enterprises that find it attractive to join in commerce that goes as much to Western and Central Europe as it does to the CIS area. And that's the future that one would hope we could get to. The moment, what I fear, is the window of opportunity for that is gradually closing because of demographic and other changes. And that to me, is something that makes the task of the current Moldovan government even more urgent to effect these reforms and get the relationship with the European Union in place so that it can be used while there is still that population there on the left bank to use it on.
I was going to say, we don't have an enormous amount of time left, so I just want to see if there are questions. I guess you had your hand up first. We'll come here, and then over here. So these.
My name is Manuel Lamotte from the World Bank. I have a question for Mr. Stoker as well for Ambassador Hill. So it's the same question, so I'll be kindly asking you to provide me with an answer. How do you think it's possible to reach to a viable solution of this frozen conflict, given the fact that Russia is so much interested in maintaining the status quo in the region, and especially particularly in Transnistria, given the fact that there are several defense factories that are hosted in the Transnistrian territory, and they are supplying Russia with military equipment and devices?
What I'd like to do is I'd like to take maybe these three questions at once, and then the panelists will have a chance to each respond as they would like.
Hi, my name is Michael Scanlon. I'm with the House Foreign Relations Committee. My question is to the panelists, whoever wishes to respond. Would be interested in hearing your respective ideas on what is the constructive role for Ukraine to play in this process, and to what degree is Ukraine's pursuit of its stated objective, joining the European Union, a defining reality for the possibilities of Moldova to do the same. Thank you.
And right over here.
My name is Ina Dubinsky, and I'm with the International Broadcasting Bureau. And I have a question to all distinguished panel. How do you expect people of Moldova make educated decisions and vote in the referendum or any sort of, you know, decision about the future of the country when they basically, the right bank and the left bank, don't have access to information, and the media market on both banks is dominated by Russian media? And any programs from Moldova to Transnistria are jammed, and the same otherwise. So they basically don't have information about each other, and whatever information from the outside world or about each other comes from the Russia-dominated media market. Thank you.
So what I'll do is we'll go down to was there one more question? Okay, we'll take one. And this will be, were there any questions over here? Because I know it's facing over here. Okay, Vlad. Since you organize this, you'll get a question, too. Yes, please.
Robert Lofter from the United States, Central and Eastern Europe Environment Foundation. In light of the recent cooperative agreement between the Republic of Moldova and Ukraine on the Dniester River, I was wondering if any of the panelists saw potentially an opportunity on the operational level of some form of cooperation or engagement by Transnistria in regards to the river.
Yeah, Vlad Spino. So nobody envisioned 20 years ago the Soviet Union will collapse. Nobody believed that the Soviet Union will withdraw its troops from Eastern Germany, from Poland and Hungary. Today, nobody believes that Russia will withdraw its troops from Moldova. So let's put our imagination at work and think if the United States, which is the best friend of Moldova, Western European country, would put more effort in discussing with Russia or withdrawal of these troops. If we take from the equation the Russian troops, then we have left with what? We have with the international actors that are key in this solution, which is Romania, which I mentioned at the beginning, this part of its territory in 1940, Republic of Moldova, and Ukraine. And my question is to the panel. Are these three actors eager to look forward to a solution that will go out of the discussion we had today on federalization, but on territory exchange of some kind, and we'll solve the solution.
Okay, now, there are 5 questions on the table, and we've got a little bit of time left, but I think this is a way to sort of, for the panelists to sort of pick from that in terms of some final broad statements. Now, the 5 questions on the table, if I remember them correctly, are on the issue of arms manufacture in Transnistria, and the factories and the interests of that. Right. So Russia's interest in terms of the arms factories. Second is whether or not Ukraine is able to play a positive role in terms of conflict resolution. Third, the issue of access to information by people on the right and left bank, and particularly in terms of how they're educated in terms of the possibilities of conflict reduction when there's a sort of a problems in terms of public media. Fourth, cooperation over the use and access to the Dniester River and other related issues having to do with the river. And finally, fifth, the sort of big question in terms of the role of the mediators and observers in terms of is this a group that is able to sort of to bring Moldova forward or work with Moldova in terms of moving forward towards conflict resolution. I'd like each of the panelists to sort of focus on whichever of those questions they would like to particularly focus on. And I'll ask each one to use those questions as sort of a way to organize sort of closing comments of about 4 minutes each. And I'll just give you a sense of when you're getting to the end of that. So I'll start with Vladimir Sokor, since we'd been hearing from Ambassadors Hill and Smith most recently. So I'll start at the end, and we'll just move down the table.
Thank you. About the Russian military presence, which goes beyond the level of industry. There are Russian troops, and there is a security service. Both of these organizations are integrated into the Russian chain of commands being run from Moscow. As long as these institutions persist in Transnistria, it is illusory to talk about a political settlement. It would also be a test of international players, all of them, bona fides and capability to directly challenge the Russian military presence in Transnistria without postponing the consideration of this issue for some hypothetical time after the internal reorganization of Moldova. Moldova wants the transformation of the existing Russian peacekeeping operation into an internationally mandated one of a civilian character with predominantly police elements. The mandating organization for this should not be the OSCE, where Russia exercising an internal veto power. It should only be the European Union. For the European Union to take a leading role in proposing a political solution, it would need to push in parallel and simultaneously on a track of equal speed for the demilitarization of Transnistria. About the possible role of Ukraine, Ukraine currently plays a constructive role, but not an active role. Ukraine has for a long time experienced considerable difficulty in clarifying its role in the negotiations to solve this conflict. The problem of to what extent are the populations on either bank of the Dniester River prepared to make an informed choice in the event of a referendum being held. As has been pointed out, they are not prepared to make an informed choice. The impact of Russian television distorts not only discussions about the Transnistria problem, but it even distorts badly Moldova's internal politics. It is a disruptive factor in Moldova's internal politics, where President Vladimir Putin enjoys top popularity ratings ahead of international and Moldovan politicians far ahead and consistently over years. And finally, the role of international players in suggesting or imposing, whatever choice of words, a settlement, including the hypothetical possibility of territorial swaps trilaterally between Romania and or Moldova and or Ukraine. I think this issue is completely ruled out. I think there will be absolutely no acceptance of such a possibility in Europe or internationally at present, at the present time, and for the foreseeable future. And there is a new interest in the European Union in accelerating the negotiations based on a German initiative known as the Meseberg Memorandum, which I believe Herman Van Rompuy, in the statement that you quoted, was alluding to. Van Rompuy made this statement 2 or 3 days ago following the Russia-EU summit in Yekaterinburg. He said there is no justification for somebody, meaning Russia, to block the negotiations. Now, there exists the Meseberg Memorandum, whereby Russia would play a constructive role in delivering a solution, unspecified, a constructive role in delivering a solution on the Transnistria issue, in return for which there would be established an EU-Russia political security committee to resolve security issues generally on the European continent. A German initiative which corresponds with the German Ostpolitik ideology of involving Russia in decision making on the European Union. So this would be the trade-off. Russia would cooperate for an unspecified solution in Transnistria in return for receiving a voice in Europe-wide security affairs to the exclusion of the United States and NATO. This is the Meseberg Memorandum signed by Angela Merkel and Dmitry Medvedev in 2002 in Meseberg near Berlin. So this is why what I mean by Moldova becoming possibly, hypothetically, an object of compensation in international trade-offs. And this is the reason why the parliament adopted in 2005 the law, it's an organic law.
Vladimir, you're going to wrap up just a second.
Okay, this is, I'm wrapping it up. The law on the principles of settling the Transnistria conflict, which rules out federalization. It is an organic law which can only be overridden by an organic majority of at least 61 or 62 votes in the Moldovan parliament, which I think would be unavailable. And this law was adopted unanimously as a legal shield, that was the operating term, a legal shield against international solutions being possibly imposed on Moldova in the interest of some international actors at the expense of Moldova's internal cohesion and functionality. Thank you.
I will only add a few words about the role of Ukraine. After Orange Revolution in Ukraine, European Union has signed two actions plan with the European Union Ukraine and the European Union Moldova in February 2005. It was the first precedent when two plans described common coherent actions on the Transnistrian issue. And as a result, on 3 of March 2006, a European Union border assistant mission along Moldo-Ukrainian border started to work, also along 452 kilometers out of the control of Central Power from Chisinau. It was a decisive action realized out of 5+2 negotiation process. And after this step, all economical agents from left Bank of Dnistria was obliged to be registered in Chisinau. In Chisinau, it's some kind of positive discrimination. They received from our custom department documents for export, but they don't pay taxes in central budget. And this is only one example of the Ukrainians' potential. And in my opinion, the attitude of Ukraine towards Transnistrian conflict definitely depends on geopolitical orientation of Ukraine. If Ukraine will sign association agreement with the European Union, I can be more or less optimistic about the perspective of common activities in order to settle this conflict. And I forget to add one very important issue. Mr. Shevchuk, who is so-called president, he is in Tiraspol. His sister lives in Chisinau. She is married in Chisinau. And the Russian troops divided them in order to avoid bloody conflict.
Master Hill.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, well, I've territorial swaps. I've heard this raised a couple of times privately by Moldovan officials in the relatively distant past, and I'm confident from reactions I've seen that no one wants to reopen the borders anywhere in Eastern Europe. So, I mean, those are bad dreams and bad ideas. On the idea on Russian arms factories, arms trading, and Russian troops, the allegations, I've become convinced of arms manufacture and arms trading are red herrings. Believe me, capable, I've heard all of the allegations. They're in the press all over, all the time. I've known some very capable people and organizations that have tried to find concrete information on this, and it has not been borne out. It just is one of those things that gets in there like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in 2002. We could be missing it if they're that good that they can hide them that well. But that's something that really does not seem to be borne out when you get down to the facts of what kind of arms, where are they. Russian troops. There are now about 1,500 Russian troops in Moldova, and there should not be one because the Moldovans don't want them in Moldova. There are, however, about 6,500, 7,000 uniformed Transnistrian army, Ministry of Interior troops, other things, they add up to about 17,000 armed people under the command of authorities in Tiraspol, as opposed to about 20,000 people in various army. Carabinieri and others, military or paramilitary formations under the command of Chisinau. If you get rid of every single Russian troop in Transnistria, you still have these two sides at each other, these two bodies, and you have to deal with that. So it's not simply a question of get the Russians out. They should be out. The counterparts throughout Europe and North America have tried to get them there. I believe the operating factor in Porto, which I personally believe was not a really bad moment in Western diplomacy, but the motivating factor there was the adopted CFE treaty, which that was where the Istanbul commitments came from, was that Western nations would not ratify and put into force the adapted CFE treaty until Russian withdrawal was completed from Georgia and Moldova. Withdrawal is not completed. Adapted CFE treaty is not ratified and implemented by anyone except four former Soviet states. It's not going to be. It's dead. CFE is dead because we held out on that. The problem remains is you're not going to get the Russian troops out by force. And I have to say that geopolitical circumstances are far less favorable now for accomplishing that task than they were in the late 90s and the early 2000s. A lot of this has to do with internal changes in the Russian regime, but not only. And that's a sad fact. We keep at it. The OSCE still has in its bank account, I believe, something like 14 million euros from the United States to help finance the destruction or withdrawal of Russian military equipment. Hopefully, my successors in the OSCE mission will get to use that at some point to get them out. That would be very good to see. But, unfortunately, the leverage of any interlocutor, the Russian Federation, on that is limited, and it's going to be tough to overcome. Is there a vision? Let me give you the one vision of success. So Wazoo has mentioned it. The Moldovan Football Federation, Tiraspol, Sheriff, is in the champion or was in the Champions League. I guess the coach got fired because the stadium, Sheriff, in Tiraspol, Transnistria, played the Moldovan national anthem and flew the Moldovan flag. No Transnistrian gimn, no Transnistrian flag, because that is something they want. I think that's the way forward for us. If we can find other things that they want that will bring people together, there are great obstacles, and you know that are very difficult to overcome. I acknowledge, but that's my hope, that we can find things that will actually lead to something that will have the Moldovan Football Federation example spread to other parts of governance and organization in the Republic of Moldova.
Quick words on the questions about Russian media and the environmental possibility of environmental cooperation. I share everyone's concern about the undue influence of Russian media, and that was true, and I guess it's before, and it's more true now. So I agree with that very serious concern. On the environmental side, that kind of cooperation is something that the United States has been supporting with small grants that are aimed at less political ways of the two sides dealing with each other, as we have been funding other media entities in Right Bank Moldova. Clearly, it would be nice if we could do more than we have been doing. It needs to be done, and I'd certainly take your point on that. But I'd like to close with a couple words on the economy and European integration, because as I see it, the Transnistria situation has so many impediments to its resolution that the new government probably should try hard and everything, but should have its top priority be European integration and greater prosperity. These are issues that are more within its control than the others we've been talking about. And it seems to me, as it has always seemed, that the underlying spur for prosperity and European integration is going to be much more investment from large, healthy economies. And to get that, Moldova needs definitively to tackle and conquer corruption. I mean, that just has to be, I mean, there has to be a Moldovan Lee Kuan Yew who is going to just take Moldova out of that realm that makes investors nervous. I hope it will happen. It would have a positive effect on Moldova and on Transnistria.
Well, thank you. With that, please join me in thanking the panelists and Ambassador Montianu for coming as well and speaking, and for their efforts that they put in today.